I like to say that there's a very profound heresy built into our country's most important national document. And that heresy is the term pursuit of happiness. Pursuit of happiness. It's a heresy because we don't get happiness by pursuing it. But it's very much a part of American life to think that we do. And in an important sense, our whole economy operates on the premise that happiness can be attained by purchasing it. There's an old joke. A woman said, every time I'm down in the dumps, I get myself a new hat. And her husband said, oh, that's where you get them. Happiness or fulfillment is a better word, I'm sure. We're thinking about the same word that the scriptures use in the Beatitude. Blessed are they. Fulfilled are they. Deeply satisfied and at ease within themselves are they. That kind of fulfillment is not secured by going out and chasing for it. It's not attained by getting, but by giving, our title for today. Jesus said it very plainly. He said, whoever would find his or her life should lose it. And whoever loses his or her life for my sake and for the gospel will find it. Happiness is a byproduct of giving ourselves away as a way of life. Ultimately, I believe that people who are in grief must come to some point where they begin to understand that the way to get past the horror of what's happening for them, the awesome, awesome emptiness, all of the things that we listed on the blackboard or the green board the other day, the way to get past that ultimately, not immediately, of course, when you're still in deep, deep pain, but ultimately, the best way to get past that is to get outside of oneself and to give oneself away. To attach yourself to something bigger than you are. Something that will outlast you. That'll still be around long after you're gone. You know what I mean? Some of you have discovered that for yourself, I'm sure. Mother Teresa is quoted as having said, many persons have a wrong idea of what constitutes true happiness. It is not attained through self-gratification, but through fidelity to a worthy purpose. And who should know better than Mother Teresa how fulfillment is found by giving yourself away to others? Yancey, in the little book, Where is God When It Hurts?, has suggested that the best way to prepare for a crisis, to get ready for the buckshot we talked about last night, is to have a strong, supportive life before it happens. You cannot suddenly, he says, fabricate foundations of strength from nowhere. They must have been building all along during your life. If you learn a pattern of depending on others and sharing yourself when you are healthy, it will be a more natural response when you're in pain. So we're talking about giving away as a way. a way of life, a way by which we understand life, and the way by which we find the fullness of life that's available to us. I've never known anybody who had a better sense of that than my good friend Fran. Fran. I'm going to get one of these tapes and give Fran a copy of this tape. Fran is my girlfriend. Well, not exactly. She calls me her boyfriend. Fran is a woman who was part of our suicide grief group many years ago. She had lost her son by suicide. He was in his 20s. And only shortly before that, she'd lost her husband. And she was in very, very deep, deep grief. But Fran came into our group with a kind of strength and serenity of personhood such as I don't think I've ever met in anybody else. And she made a wonderful contribution to our circle of grieving people, because she always came with something to say that would have the effect of moving us along. Sometimes in a group of that kind where you share a lot of feelings with one another, you have the feeling that we're not really moving, we're not really going anywhere. We are, but it's not always evident that we are. And Fran would get a little impatient with our sitting there and getting all somber about the things that had happened. And she'd tell a joke or she'd introduce something. And she knew how to do it in a way that didn't come off as frivolous or putting people down. It just came out of who she is. She's just great. She's a little person. She's no taller than that. When she hugs me, she's got to reach way up, and I got to reach way down. Well, Fran, not too long after she went through our grief group, decided to go to Africa. And she hooked herself up. She's a very, very devout Roman Catholic. She goes to Mass every day. She has a little altar in her apartment where she prays every day. She also has a bird that she calls Ollie. Fran and Ollie live in this apartment. And she hooked herself up with a mission over in Africa, and she went over there and lived in this mission for 5 or 6 months, doing whatever they wanted her to do. She said they were all men, they were carpenters, they were building a new chapel, and there were native. African people living in the complex, and there were some other people from other countries living there working on this project. And she'd do the woman's work, as she put it with me. She'd do the baking and the cooking and fixing and kind of keep all these men cheered up a little bit, was how she saw her mission. And she just had a wonderful time. Unfortunately, she became ill. She's not young anymore. She's in her upper 60s and had to come back to the United States. And after she came back to the United States, she decided she wanted to be a nun at her age. And she couldn't find any order that would take her on as a novice. But she did finally locate an order out in Boston, and got in touch with them, and went out to Boston, and entered into the life of the nuns as a novice, and was very determined that she was going to be a nun. Her children thought she was nuts. Her children are in their 40s or so, and they thought Mom had lost it, going out to be a nun when you're 60, whatever it is, and a widow, and a mother, leave your family in Minneapolis and go to Boston to be a nun, for crying out loud, who'd do that? And nobody would do that unless you really lost your mind. And she joked about that. She was not allowed to have contact with her family while she was in the nunnery, and they didn't know how it was going for her, and she but she was determined. She was going to find this way as an avenue of service and spend the rest of her life being useful, you know? That's how she'd find fulfillment. Well, that didn't work either, because she had a lot of problems with her legs, and the problem was that the nuns prayed a long time. The nuns would be on their knees for a long time. And she discovered that some arthritis and other kinds of leg stuff didn't work for her to be on her knees for hours and hours at a time. And some other health problems intervened. So she left that and came back to Minneapolis. Right now she's looking for another adventure to figure out how to give herself away to something really worthwhile. She volunteers in her parish in Minneapolis, and she reaches out to people in the most wonderful, wonderful way. I love Fran a lot. She told me that out in Boston, she said that her best friend in Minneapolis, her boyfriend in Minneapolis, was a Lutheran minister. she's nuts. Fran, you're nuts. She's funny. Fran and Ollie. I wish we could all get something of that spirit. I wish I could get more of that spirit. Rabbi Kushner, in his little book that we talked about last night, says we need to get over the questions that focus on the past and on the pain. Why did this happen to me? Those kinds of questions. And ask instead the question which opens the doors to the future, a question like, now that this has happened, what shall I do about it? Now that this has happened, what am I going to do about it? Now, please understand, I'm not saying you do this the day after somebody's died. I'm not talking about what happens for us in the immediate, acute agony of grief. I'm talking about a longer picture after some time has elapsed. I really believe that this giving of ourselves is the way that we can give meaning to the terrible thing that's happened to us. After Helen died by suicide, my first wife, for those of you who may not have been here before, I couldn't find any meaning in that. Suicide is absurd. It doesn't make any sense. It doesn't fit into this presumed to be intelligent universe with some kind of design that we sort of have in our viscera somewhere, is the way that the world is put together. We talked about that last night a little bit. There wasn't any meaning in Helen's death that I could figure out. Well, then sometime after I moved to the Twin Cities, I got a telephone call from a woman whom I didn't know, and she'd heard about me some way. I don't really know how she'd heard about me, but she knew that I was a suicide survivor. And she asked me if I'd be interested in helping her put together a support group for suicide survivors. Well, I'd never done any support work group work before. Some pastors have had groups meeting in their churches and so on, and have had a lot of support group experience, but I never had. But I'm kind of dumb, you know. I'll do anything once, at least once. Sometimes I'll do it more than once. So I said, sure, let's do that. And we started a support group, which originally met just three or four of us who knew each other, got to know each other, met in each other's homes, and then we decided that if this was going to be a useful kind of group for a larger group of people, we needed to have a place to meet and a time, and then advertise it across the metropolitan area so that people could find us. And through the cooperation of the Hennepin County Mental Health Association, we got a mailing out that went to every professional group that you can think of around a death. Funeral directors, medical people, nurses, social workers, who else? Police, ambulance drivers. Every possible professional grouping you can think of got a mailing about our grief group, and people started to come. That group is now 14 years old, has met twice a month all of that period of time, and the first 10 years or so I met with them as their facilitator. Ah, that gave meaning to Helen's death. That gave meaning to Helen's death. Do you understand that? All of a sudden, I was caught up in a whole realm of activity that I never thought I'd ever be a part of. And so exciting to see people come wiped out, not even able to talk, and to see them move along to a point where they could feel not altogether okay, but okay. You know what we're saying. We're playing with this not okay, okay stuff. People who now could, as we said the other day, begin to close the door gently on what had happened and begin to walk into the future with some confidence toward tomorrow, where this death was no longer the focal point through which they saw every moment of their life, but now they could move along from there. And I have had opportunity to speak with groups of police, with clergy, with nurses. Somebody here this week told me she'd heard me as in a nurse group at North Memorial Hospital. I don't even remember it. I do that so often. And to high school classes, to college classes, all over the place. And every time I do that, I think to myself, this is for you, Helen. You gave me this. This was your gift to Verlin. She gave me this gift today to be with you folks this week. I wouldn't be here today with you if it weren't for the fact that Helen, in her great agony, decided that death was more inviting than life and hanged herself from a rafter in our house. But the important thing to see in that is sometimes events do not appear to have any intrinsic meaning, but maybe we can give meaning to those events, those terrible things that happen to us. But I am going to suggest it doesn't happen automatically. I mean, we don't sit and wait for meaning to take place. One needs to give some effort to that, to commit oneself to finding meaning, locating meaning. That's how I think about all of this stuff. I don't know whether that makes any sense to you or not, but that's how I think about it. What we're saying is that your pain takes on meaning when it opens you up to other people. And you've all noticed, I'm sure, that people who are suffering from some kind of hurt find each other. If you're a cancer victim, wow, all of a sudden you know all the cancer victims in town. If you've been divorced, you get acquainted with, soon the people who've been divorced start telling you about that. The deepest bonding that happens among human beings happens right here. It's like we're Siamese twins connected at the belly. Bonding doesn't happen with heads. Heads have a wonderful time, of course, discussing all kinds of wonderful things. But and that's fun, and it can be bonding. Language in itself is bonding. Words are sacred because they're part of what God has created for us to know each other. But the deepest bonding happens at the point of where we're really in pain, where we're hurting. Dorothy Zole, in that book, Suffering, that I showed you last night, it ends her book, nearly at the end, by saying that that one should bear the burden of another is the simple and clear call that comes from suffering. That one should bear the burden of another is the simple and clear call that comes from suffering. There's an old Swedish proverb that says, I don't know who it was that taught this to me. I'm not Swedish, but I served a Swedish congregation. I was the first Gentile to be pastor there. Somebody in the congregation told me this. I think it might have been Birgit. She's a wonderful Swedish woman that I cared about a lot. She used to say, I think it was she who used to say, shared joy is double joy, and shared sorrow is half sorrow. That's kind of neat. I've always wondered about this issue of meaning in suffering. Now, there's a Roman Catholic tradition that goes back into the Middle Ages that talks a lot about the meaning of suffering. I remember when I was very young, we had a Roman Catholic hospital in Rapid City, South Dakota, where I grew up. And I think it was my dad was in the hospital, and I was walking the corridor. And here was a sign that said, "Don't waste your suffering." I still don't really understand what that sign was supposed to be saying. But there's a very powerful tradition going in Roman Catholic thought that suffering has intrinsic meaning. And I puzzle over that. And I believe it's not evident that suffering has meaning, but we can give meaning to suffering is what we're trying to say today. Now, sometimes we don't quite know how to go about that. There was an article in the Lutheran magazine a few years ago about how people had responded when somebody was in grief and they told somebody about it. I'd like to have you tell me what's wrong with this response. Jim tells his friend Sue, who's just been diagnosed as having terminal cancer, he says, "Sue, God can heal you. Expect a miracle. If you have enough faith, you'll be healed." Do you like that response? Why not? What's wrong with it? Right. Well, if you have enough faith, you'll be healed. Yeah, if you're not healed. Right. Putting God on the spot, yeah. I remember a student one time who said she really wanted to find a neat man to marry. She really wanted to have a family and felt the years were getting along and she didn't have a man. And she asked me to pray to God for her to have a husband. And then she said, "And if I get a husband, then I'll believe in God." I told her, "Sorry, I won't be a part of that game. I won't be a part of that gamble. That's not the way we do operate." And that's the problem with a lot of so-called faith healing. Now, I think there may be faith healing. I don't want to be altogether skeptical or cynical about that, but One of the difficulties with faith healing is that it promises an awful lot and it cannot always deliver. And what it does is put people in an awful place if they think that their faith is going to heal them, and then it doesn't happen. Right? Well, what about this one? In another instance, Jane says to Alice, whose child was stillborn. What does Jane say to Alice? God doesn't put any more on us than we can stand. You like that response? Pardon me?
That's just not very comforting.
Well, Jane thinks it is, doesn't she? Ah. The assumption back of what Henry's saying is that God is the one who killed this child, right? It feels like that's what she's saying. And it's a big ought kind of statement too, isn't it? You should, you ought to manage this some way because, you know, that's, if you're really religious, God is really with you, it's going to work itself out, huh? How about this one? A third cliche comes from Sarah. Sorry if there's any Sarah here, but who, having heard of a relative's fatal heart attack, turns to a friend and says, "I guess we shouldn't question God's will." How do you feel about that one? You like that? Nobody likes that. What's wrong with that one? What's wrong with that? Must have been God's will. We ought not question God's will. God caused the heart attack. Must be God's will. We don't want to defy God's will. The person who says that really feels very good about their faith and being right with God and all that. Yeah? Yeah. I think this term, God's will, ought to be shelved. We ought to just take that out and put it somewhere in storage for about 200 years. That's a very, very tricky term. How do we know what is God's will? One of my professors in college used to say, maybe you can have some very small inkling of God's will in retrospect, after the fact. But he said, I don't think you can ever know it in advance, or even in the present. Where is God at work in the world, and what is God up to, and all of that? This is a big subject. It's sort of what we were talking about last night, framed in another way. But don't you hear that so often? Must be the will of God. There's a fatalism back of that statement that is not in keeping with Christianity. It's more in keeping with Muslim theology. So I don't know Muslim theology all that well, and if there's a Muslim present, you might come at me about that. But there's much more of a fatalistic sense. Remember that movie with Dorothy Day? What was the name of it? It was set in North Africa, and the theme song was "Que sera, sera, whatever will be." My daughter asks me, you remember all those words? Que sera, sera in French, I think, means whatever will be. So you just translate it, whatever will be. That's how it will be, because it's supposed to be. And a lot of Christians get caught up in that kind of fatalism. I know a woman who says that all the time. Every time something happens, she'll say, well, I guess that's God's will. That's the way it's supposed to be. And she even makes decisions that way. You know, pray and then, which car shall I buy, a Buick or a Oldsmobile? And then you get a sign of some kind, and God tells you, buy an Oldsmobile. I'm being silly. No, but it's almost like that for her. It's almost that frivolous. That's strange from my standpoint, strange. And she's not saying, which is the more intelligent thing for me to do? What she's saying is, which is the thing that God has already decided I should do? So what I'm going to do is ask God what God wants me to do, and then I'll be, if I know what God wants me to do, then I'll be sure that I've done the right thing. I can't go wrong, even if the Buick people say it's dumb to buy an Oldsmobile. Isn't true? Okay. That's a pretty good response. I don't think it's true either. I think time has a healing effect. If I get a cut in my hand, I always think about the miracle every day you look at it and it's different. Your body is repairing it in some way. And there is a sense in which our bodies repair themselves, our psyches repair themselves when they've been injured. That's true, but time is neutral, really, and a whole lot of it is dependent upon what we do with that time. If we sit and wait for something to happen and to have our grief resolved sort of automatically, that's not advisable. That's not the way to go about it. The way to go about it is to find ways to be helpful to oneself.
What about just praying the Lord's Prayer and saying, thy will be done?
Thy will be done, yeah. Whatever it is. Remember how Jesus prayed that in Gethsemane? Remove this cup, but thy will be done. I don't know what your will is, whatever it is. I like that prayer. I think ultimately the most open prayer is to say, God, I don't know how to do this. If there's some way you can figure this out for me, I'm available. Well, when people come to us in great pain, as these people in this article were doing, we often don't know what to say, do we? Many times you find yourself unable to find words. You'd like to find the words that will heal them immediately, or find a button to push and they'll be okay, just like that. Sometimes I think we're so astounded. Somebody tells us something, and we're just aghast at the story we've heard. And we're caught off guard. We don't know how to come back. It's been suggested that sometimes we feel guilty when somebody tells us about something that's happened, because things have been going relatively well for me, and somebody comes to me, and I feel guilty. When I learned a couple of months ago that my brother, who's 3 years younger than I am, had to have prostate cancer surgery, I felt kind of guilty. Why should that be happening to him and not to me? Maybe someday it will happen to me. I mean, I'll get another kind of buckshot. That's his buckshot for right now. I want to repeat what I was saying the other day when we met around suicide, that there are a couple of things that we must not say or must not do when people come to us in pain. And they both start with A, so you'll never forget, right? Let me ask those of you who were there the other day on suicide. Tell me, what are those two things? You're going to remember, right?
Argue.
Argue? and advise. Right. They both start with A's. You'll never forget now. Ever. Ever. Argue and advise. Somebody comes to me and says, I really feel crappy. I don't know what I'm going to do. I just feel awful. And my response is, well, I don't know why you feel that way. You're young and you're vigorous and it's a beautiful sunny day outside. What am I doing? I'm saying there's something wrong with the way you feel. I'm arguing with their feeling, their stated feeling. Or the other thing I do is to say, well, you know what I think you ought to do? Take a vacation, find a new friend, go fishing, or whatever. Well, what am I doing when I do that? Either of those two. Arguing and advising. What am I doing when I argue and advise? I'm really judgmental of their feeling, right? Yes, I'm judging their feeling. And what I'm doing is talking down to them from some kind of superior posture that I know better what's good for you than you do. And that person is going to resent it. Now, you've had this happen to you, haven't you? Both of these things. Have you ever done it for somebody else? Yeah, we've all done it. We've all done it. And when we do it out of our best heart, we really want to help. We really think that's going to help. And instead what it does is to build a huge wall between me and that person. Instead of a bridge, I got a wall. That person's never going to come around and talk to Smith again if I come with those kinds of judgmental responses. Furthermore, what I'm doing is giving that person my head. And what that person wants is not my head. That person wants my heart. That person wants my all. That's what we mean by heart, isn't it? We say we're to love God with our whole heart. We don't mean just that little organ that's going in. We mean everything, all that we are. That's what a person wants. When somebody comes to my office as a pastor and lays her heart out or his heart out on the floor, just weeping, I don't want my wisdom, my words. And we clergy are the worst of all on this. We're trained to talk, aren't we, Ron? Huh? And we think words are going to fix people up. We've got the Word of God, after all. That's a pretty powerful instrument for fixing people. We're fix-it people, we clergy. We're trained to fix people. And I don't think we can fix anybody. We have enough trouble fixing ourselves. I think a person has to fix himself or herself. And the best that I can do, the best I can do as a caring person is in some very, very modest way help to contribute to an environment within which that person can more quickly fix himself or herself. And the most important ingredient in that environment is love. And if I can convey to that person, I love you, I care for you. I really do care for you. I really do care what's happening for you. Then that has the effect of providing an environment within which that person can move toward becoming more okay. And as I said the other day, I absolutely believe that the most obscene thing that one human being can say to another, use all the four-letter words, I don't care, my ears have heard them all, anyhow. But please don't ever, ever tell another human being not to cry. I don't care how old that person is or how young that person is, please, 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 never, ever tell another human being not to cry. Please don't do that. That's awful. That's awful. You're telling that person not to cry because you're so blooming uncomfortable. You're not telling that person not to cry because you care about that person. You're telling that person not to cry because you care about yourself. And you're uncomfortable and you can't stand that person's crying. It's really where it's coming from. So please don't do that. I like to say that's like telling a person not to have a bowel movement. And you'd never tell somebody not to have a bowel movement. Now, would you? Would you ever say, don't ever have a bowel movement? We know that it's urgently important that people have bowel movements. And when they don't have bowel movements, we give them some medicine so that they can have bowel movements. We know people have to get rid of the fill in the blank. Now, if that's true physically, it's also true emotionally. And when we're crying, what we're doing is having a bowel movement. And the sad thing is that most men don't even know what I'm talking about. Most men are emotionally constipated. Go ahead, women, tell your man you're full up to here. Chances are he is. But you women know what I'm talking about, don't you? You know that a good cry is just wonderful. I'm not talking about a little, you know, snivel. I'm talking about a shoulder shaking, out of control bawl. Oh, God, that feels good. It feels just like the morning after Ex-Lax. Huh? It just cleans out the whole system. It's what the Greeks call catharsis. It's a cleansing event. And it's so healthy. I believe that that's one reason why women live longer than men do. And I've checked this with a couple of medical doctors, and they have not disagreed with me. That one reason why men die at an earlier age is because they're full of crap. And that piled up manure creates hypertension and cardiac arrest. People die from that. They do. They die from that. And if we don't know how to cry, we've got to learn how to cry, I believe. And I tell high school classes, I have a lot of fun with this, they laugh, of course. I tell high school classes, if you don't already have one, find yourself a poop partner. Somebody you can poop with. Somebody that you can be really honest with. And know that that person isn't going to come back on you with one of these absurd responses that we just read a little while ago. Is not going to judge the way you feel. You can't do that with everybody, right? You can't lay your heart out in front of the public. I believe that that's what Jesus meant when he said, don't throw your pearls before swine. They'll trample on it. They'll take advantage of you. You know what I'm saying? If you expose your vulnerabilities, lots of people will take advantage of that. They'll use that against you. So you have to be careful about that. You have to be very selective about poop partners. And I tell the kids, if you are very, very fortunate, if you're a very fortunate teenager, your mom or your dad may be your poop partner. Some moms and dads are poop partners to their kids. But not very many, sad to say. Not very many. Talk to high school kids. Can you talk to your mom or your dad about really what's really going on for you? Oh, God, no. Tell my dad. It's the last thing you can do. Can you tell your pastor? The pastor. Can't tell your pastor. If you're very, very fortunate, you'll marry a poop partner. Can you imagine Johnny saying to Mary under the moonlight, "Mary, will you be my poop partner?" Huh? But a lot of married people are not poop partners either. Sad to say, very sad to say. There are many married people who can take off their physical clothes in front of each other. That's relatively easy. But they'll never take off their emotional clothes. Fiddle, I can take off my physical clothes right now. I'll do it right now if you want me to. And all you women will run away, and all you men will stay out of curiosity. So we need a poop partner. And I got a kick out of an article that was in the Star Tribune in Minneapolis a while back that had this high-powered research program that had discovered that teenage kids place their confidence when they want to talk to somebody more so with teenage kids than with anybody else. Oh, I wonder how much it costs to get that research done. Sometimes research is so brilliant. What does a poop partner do? Poop partner listens. That's right. Listens. Short on words, big on ears. Somebody said we have two ears and one mouth, and that says something. We ought to listen twice as much as we talk. We preachers need to hear that. There are no words needed, absolutely no words needed in that situation. I said the other day that when I was a young pastor doing hospital visitation, it occurred to me that the nurse comes in with a tray load of pills, and Smith comes in with a tray load of words, and they're both supposed to have medicinal value. I got thinking one day, this is crazy. This person doesn't need my words. What this person needs is my presence, just to be there. And what is so absolutely marvelous as a pastor is to realize that when you go and sit with a suffering person, that person has the sense that this is the presence of God. Oh, that's more than I can be. But I think any of us can be the presence of God, can be the sacred to which one can speak. I think the most beautiful thing I've ever heard a grieving person say about what somebody did for him was a man whose wife had just killed herself. And he told us in our support group, "My neighbor said to me, John," I don't know if that was his name, I don't remember, Ron, I think was his name, "every Thursday night from now on, there's going to be an extra place at our dinner table. There'll be an extra chair every Thursday night. Now, you don't have to come there. You don't have to occupy that chair if you don't want to. There's no pressure on this. But just know, that every Thursday night there'll be a chair for you at our dinner table." Isn't that nifty? Huh? How wonderful, how caring, how beautiful. And he told about how much that meant to him. I came across this poem one time not too long ago. It says, "The sense of belonging flows from trust. Trust is the gradual acceptance of others. with their gifts and their limits, each one with the call of Jesus. And this leads to the realization that the body of community is not perfectly whole and cannot be, that this is our human condition. And it is all right for us to be less than perfect. Must have been reading, it's okay not to be okay. We must not weep over our imperfections. We are not judged for being defective. Our God knows that in so many ways we are lame and half blind. We will never win the Olympics of humanity racing for perfection, but we can walk together in hope, celebrating that we are loved in our brokenness, helping each other, growing in trust, living in thanksgiving, learning to forgive, opening to others, welcoming them, and striving to bring peace and hope to our world. So it is that we come to put down roots in community, not because it is perfect and wonderful, but because we believe that Jesus has called us together. It is where we belong. And it is where we are called to grow and to serve. Finally, some years ago, I was given a wonderful little book of poems. It's out of print, and I prized this. I thought today I'd lost it, and I just got frantic. It was inside of one of my other books, thank goodness. I've got to photocopy this in case it does get lost, because it's just wonderful stuff. It's written by a woman whose good friend had killed herself. And there's anger in this poem. Do not tell me of the research that measures and defines what I feel, that builds a reasonable structure in which I can contain my grief. Do not bring me the books that give a comprehensive analysis of steps and stages with reasonable suggestions on how to get through and over this pain. Do not counsel me with equations like patience plus work multiplied by time equals a reasonable recovery. I am not a problem to be solved. I will feel this pain for longer than I can now imagine, for this unreasonable event, there will be no end to my wailing. Perhaps God will hear and stay to listen. Perhaps God will let me have my grief. I didn't know whether I was going to tell you about this or not. Today's my wedding anniversary. 17 years ago today, I was married to Jerry. And 1 month ago today, we were divorced. So, this is not a good day. There are times, they say, when the desert blooms with flowers and growing green. When the air is touched and freshened by a gentle breeze, the desert blooms, they say. The seasons change, and the silence is broken by a sound of rain. I hope so. Oh God, I hope so.